Welcome to the Planet Podcast. My name is Patrick Roanhouse, and I'm the host of this show. We are here specially out of the Twit Cottage in Petaluma with the Chief Twit himself, Leo Laporte.
Hello. I feel like somebody named the Chief Twit should talk like this.
You think?
I don't know. Chief Twit. I get kind of like you're this host, this media control center. It's like almost like on the verge of like, we'll let you know what you want to know.
I feel like Rick Wakeman. Remember from Yes? And he would sit and he would have 8 keyboards all around him. I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I only have 6. But I do have 14 computers all around me.
Out of references to keyboards, I can only think of Electric Light Orchestra.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
So, basically, I've been a fan of yours for a long time. And
thank you.
As someone who has been through the industry of tech journalism, particularly broadcast journalism, you have a very interesting history. You're originally from Connecticut, correct?
I was born in New York City.
Okay.
When I was about 3, my dad, who was a graduate student at Columbia, got a job teaching geology at Brown University. So I moved. I just decided to move all by myself at the age of 3 to Providence, Rhode Island, where I lived until I was in ninth grade. And then in 10th grade, we moved to California.
Okay.
And I'm staying here. You can't get rid of me. I love California.
So you have an interesting background. You got accepted to Yale.
I don't know how that happened.
Wow.
That was a mistake.
So you got accepted to Yale for and you started doing Asian Chinese studies, correct?
Yeah. Well, you know, back then I suppose it's still true that you have to study a language, right? Mm-hmm. And I had studied French in high school, and I don't know what happened, but I just got the idea, oh, it'd be kind of cool to learn Chinese. And so I took Chinese as my language, but what happened is I fell in love with the culture. I was really kind of a history major. That was my real interest. Mm-hmm. And Chinese history, of course, is the longest recorded history, and so I just fell in love with it. I mean, it's an amazing story. And you have to pick a major. I think probably even then I knew I would never graduate, but at least you have to pick a major, so I did.
Yeah. Now, the one thing is, you didn't exactly finish the program at Yale, correct?
I did not. I dropped out my junior year halfway through because I found the campus radio station, frankly, and fell in love with radio.
Now, it's an interesting thing. Growing up that you had a father who was a professor, what kind of, you know, reaction did you get from your parents when you said, hey, Mom, Dad, I've decided I want to drop out of school. I want to do this radio broadcasting thing.
I don't really remember. I was talking to my mom. She was just out here for my daughter's high school graduation, and she said that I called, and I said, I found what I want to do, and it's radio. And my parents were pretty cool, and I think probably at what their reaction was, great. He's found what he wants to do. I mean, they probably also had a little bit of a reaction. What do we spend all this money for Yale for? But I think in the long run, they were supportive. I think that when you, and now as a parent, I kind of understand that when your kid comes to you and says, I've fallen in love with something, this is something I really love and I really want to do, you feel pretty good. Mm-hmm. That's something you hope for your children, you know?
So you started doing sports broadcasting, I believe, correct? I remember.
No. The first thing, I was a DJ for years.
Okay.
So I was a DJ at WYBC, which is the Yale radio station. And at the time, the way the Yale radio station was kind of crazy. They had the college kids were doing classic rock, because that's what college kids do, rock and roll. This was the mid-70s, all day. And then at night, the whole station went to R&B. They called it Black Spectrum, an R&B programming that wasn't Yaley's. It was people from the town. So it was kind of a crazy station. It was a little schizophrenic. So I went there. I read news. I did some silly stuff, played music, but eventually worked my way up to program director there. And I said, you know, we really ought to make this station a little bit more unified. So what if we do jazz in the daytime and R&B at night? At least it kind of flow a little bit better. And so we converted to a jazz station. I don't know what it is now, but that was kind of my introduction to radio management.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I left and moved back to California, I went around saying, yes, I've got all this experience. I've run a radio station, and I'm a DJ. And they said, you don't have any experience, kid. That was in college. That doesn't count at all. So it was very hard to get a job. I worked as a busboy at a Denny's restaurant and at a record store trying to find work. Never, you know, it took me probably a year to find a radio station job. I picked the cheesiest, meanest, smallest station I could find, which was a little tiny station on Monterey's Cannery Row in an old whorehouse. And I figured this is the worst station. I got to be able to get a job there.
Related to the music business, that sounds kind of apropos.
Yeah, it really was. And they were playing oldies, I think. And it took me the longest time. I banged on the door, and finally the guy said, well, kid, you're a diamond in the rough, but we're going to give you a chance. So they gave me the overnight shift, midnight to 6 a.m. Sunday morning, running church broadcasts. And then I would get like 1 hour on the air. But I must have been all right because I worked my way up there. I eventually became music director, and I can't remember what shift I ended up working. I think afternoon drive. I hated mornings because it was too early in the morning. So I was a DJ for a long time. I only started doing talk radio later in my career in the mid-'80s.
Okay. Now, you first got interested in technology when it came to computers. What was the first computer that really, like, you were like, this computer thing, this is interesting. I like where this is going.
Well, it was an Atari game system.
Mm-hmm.
What was it? Was it VCS? The 2600. And I got it as a game system because I used to love to go. There was a thing called Chuck E. Cheese Pizza Time Theater. Nolan Bushnell, the guy had founded Atari, had started these.
Many fond memories.
You remember the Chuck E. Cheese?
With the scary animatronic.
Scary!
Yeah.
But it had an arcade, and I used to go there and drop a lot of quarters into Battle Zone. That was my favorite game. I finally figured out how to beat Battle Zone. There was just a little trick you could do that you would win every time. Donkey Kong, I love. So I was playing those games, and finally I said, I got to save some money. So I got an Atari 2600, and I liked the games. I liked them a lot. And I thought, well, I can play better games if I get an Atari 400 computer. So this is probably 78, 79. So I got a 400. And I started writing basic programs. You know, I got the tape cassette, and I started punching in programs from Compute Magazine, eventually writing my own. It was really fun. I talked the boss at the radio station into buying an early CPM computer called a North Star Advantage. It had very elaborate vector graphics. It was a very fancy computer. We bought at great expense, hideous expense, a 5 megabyte hard drive. 5 megabytes. And I talked him into buying a C compiler, Whiteside C, which was probably also $1,000 or more for this 5 megabyte hard drive. And but I mostly did the programming in the North Star Basic, which was a pretty good basic.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote him a system for taking all the research on songs and putting a graph up. He never really much used it, but I fell in love with it. So, and this is in San Jose. This is in Silicon Valley in 1979, 1980. This is when it's really taken off.
So you were a full-blown app developer then in your early days?
I loved programming. It was so much fun. And then, you know, after the Atari, I think I probably around 81 got an IBM PC clone. I couldn't afford an actual IBM, but I remember we got a bunch of Eagle PCs, which were IBM PC clones. And I was already a pretty serious hobbyist. I was writing for InfoWorld and Byte Magazine to support my hobby. I wrote for some Atari magazines. So even though I was only a DJ, this was at KLOK in San Jose, during the day, at night, I was really into computers.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. I had been, as a teenager, really into chess. Loved chess. I was a very serious chess player, played in tournaments and stuff. Not great, but I was good enough, and I really loved it. And I think when I found computers, it was that part of me that really got excited about it, and programming especially. It was kind of like chess. It was very logical, very mental occupation that I just loved. And so I stopped playing chess and started to, and you can see there's a lot of chess stuff around.
Yeah, I noticed
here.
When I walked into your the cottage that there's the large chess board right there at the entranceway.
Yeah, and there's a big demonstration board over here. And I love chess still, but I'm not a very good player, but computers really kind of took its place.
So you went from doing just radio to then doing, it was ZDTV, correct?
Oh, well, now we're jumping way ahead because...
What was the in-between between radio and then going...
I did radio. Okay, so I started in talk radio in 86. Around 91, I got fired. A guy named Rush Limbaugh took over the middays in 550 stations around the country. And I and 550 midday jocks lost our jobs. But they said, but you could do the weekends. We're going to have you do cars. We're going to have you do cooking. And each show would have an expert come in. And I, you know, it was the Carey Brothers and Home Improvement. It was, you know, it was Anthony Dias Blue on wine. It was just a bunch of shows. Ray Brown on real estate. And I'd be the announcer. And I said, all right, I'll do this. And it's like 9 hours a day, 2 days a week. It was exhausting. I said, I'll do this if you let me do a computer show with John C. Dvorak. So John and I did a computer radio show. Eventually, we syndicated it. And by 92 or 93, I stopped doing the other specialty shows and just was doing computer talk. And didn't start doing TV until around that time. I had met with the CNET folks when they were first starting up. Halsey Miner wanted to do a 24-hour technology television channel. And I was doing technology, syndicated technology radio show. So he said, you're the guy. You know more about it than anybody else. And he hired me, and I did some research on how to do a cable channel on technology. And I told him it's going to cost you, you know, $500 million before you make any money at all. He said, well, I guess we won't do that. And then they, I did their first pilot, John C. Dvorak and I, and Stuart Alsop and Fred Davis, Gina Smith, all my friends at that time. We did a roundtable show, kind of like Twit, pilot for them, but it was terrible. My hair was slicked back. It was just awful.
Kind of like a Charlie Rose. Like
yeah, it was very Charlie Rosey. They said, thank you. See you later. But along comes Ziff Davis. In fact, I remember Halsey Miner was kind of my farewell interview. He said, he handed me a press release. He said, Ziff Davis is looking for people. Maybe you should talk to them. Bye. So I went over to Ziff Davis and got a job with them doing a TV show, early TV show for them with Gina Smith called the PC Computing Show. Jim Latterback was the co-host on that. And that's when I started getting into television.
Now, it was really interesting at the time that Tech TV and when it first started, ZDTV was on the air. I think personally it was one of the first times you saw a lot of technical issues being brought to air to people. I mean, my parents watched Tech TV and Call for Help when you were on there.
Oh, that's great.
It was either that or, you know, McNeil and Lara NewsHour on PBS.
Well, I was in very good company.
Yes, yes. With the rise of Tech TV, you then, after many years of it being there, there was the fall. The purchase by Comcast and the merger with G4.
Yeah.
It was interesting, your response to that. You started basically Twit out of that.
Well, if there's a thread in everything that I just talked about, the thread is, and this is true of anybody who's a broadcaster, in every case, you get to do it only as long as the powers that be let you do it. And whether you've built something great or not, it's just as long as they let you do it. They own the channel. So I really, after, you know, time and time again, being fired for Rush Limbaugh, being, you know, told we don't want to use you on the site because you're too ugly. You know, just all time and time again, I finally said, and after the last straw was spending 6 years, I and hundreds of other people working really hard to make Tech TV something very good, very significant, and very successful. Comcast says, nice job. Thanks. See you later. So I decided never again. If I build something next time, it's going to be for myself. I want control. I don't want somebody to be able to pull the rug out from under me. So the internet gave me that capability. You know, Twit is basically, you know, it's internet broadcasting. And with cheap equipment, I didn't have to have a lot of expensive, fancy equipment. I had most of it because I was already doing radio. And the internet made distribution easy. So, you know, the time was right for me to do my own thing. And I was very glad to do it because I didn't want anybody to steal it out from under me again.
Now, for my guests who don't actually, who don't watch Twit or listen to Twit, they have a really amazing setup here. There's at least, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, like six cameras that are all high-end Canon, you know, digital out, all in HD. And you have a computer back here that's set up as well. You call this Skypeosaurus.
Yeah, our former vice president of engineering built this. What a great device this is. We started, you know, Skype was the thing that made Twit possible because none of my hosts are in the same town as me. I live in a small town in Northern California. So we were able to Skype them. And initially we were just audio and we just did a Skype conference call. But when we went to video, we wanted to be able to see everybody and we couldn't because Skype only at the time let you do one video call at a time. So the solution was to put four computers together, four screens, and make four separate Skype calls. And that's what Skypeosaurus is. It's really four computers, but they're bound together so that it's like one computer, and I can have four separate Skype images on there. And it works great. And we have separate audio, too, which means if somebody sounds bad, we can clean up their audio independently, that kind of thing.
Now, it's interesting over time, like the evolution of the Twit Cottage. This is what you call your little bunker of, you know, sending out your own signal because you can't stop it. You know, a little Firefly reference there to the fans.
You can't stop the signal.
You've evolved it from being, you know, being analog mixers to now straight digital. How is that kind of like when I think recently, a couple of months ago, you actually told people like how much you earned. You know, it's something you like to keep down on the, you know, under the table.
I don't really keep it that secret because I want podcasters to know it is possible to be successful and make money in podcasting. Mm-hmm. So it's not really a secret. I've never really hidden how much we make.
But, I mean, like, it's always something that people don't like to always talk about. Like, you
well,
never ask about
it's gauche to talk about money, right? It's considered gauche. But I've been willing to expose a lot of the inner workings of Twit because, first of all, I feel I have kind of a little bit of a responsibility to our audience. Twit exists because of them, but also because I want to let other people who are thinking about this as a business kind of know how it works. Mm-hmm. I don't mind doing that.
Do you think that it's like, you still have large broadcast centers like MSNBC, CNN, still as the everyday kind of thing. And, like, you used to have, like, your single broadcaster, like, you know, your Walter Cronkites. Now in the new generation of the digital age, you have, you know, your Leo Laportes, your, you know.
It's very fragmented. Isn't
it's very fragmented and very hard to find a single message that you can listen to. I had the same discussion with Natalie Del Conte when I had her on the show. And what's your view on that?
That's like fantastic. Why should Walter Cronkite have so much power?
Okay. But I mean, like, what do you think about, like, the aggregation of that? Like, as a final thought, like, with the aggregation of news, with it being
here's the problem.
By people.
In the first of all, mass media is a brand new phenomenon. Mm-hmm. We kind of think it's always been around, but really it hasn't. It's only been around since broadcasting began at the turn of the last century. So it's brand new. And in the early days of it, the first 100 years, it was so expensive that only the oligarchs, the very wealthy, could afford to own a radio or a TV station, a record studio, or a movie studio. You were very wealthy. And those people decided who got a voice and what that voice said, period. Which is not democratic. It's not the way things should be. But there was the only way it could be because it was so expensive. Along comes digital technology and the internet, and suddenly anybody who wants to say something can very inexpensively make it and perfectly freely distribute it over YouTube and a variety of other channels. And so what has that done? Well, it's certainly produced a lot of stuff that maybe nobody wants to watch because there's, you know, 24 hours a minute uploaded to YouTube. It's a lot of stuff you can't watch, but it's also produced a ton of great stuff, and it's given everybody a chance to say their piece and have their thoughts be heard. Now, it does mean that there's no one obvious place to go, but I think that that's undemocratic. Why, you know, that's why should you have Walter Cronkite determine the national agenda? Who's he? Who's he to determine that? Or worse, the people who own CBS, the people who own NBC. Why should General Electric get to determine what the national agenda is? They shouldn't. So everybody gets a voice. How does your voice get heard? By being good. So if you say something that is a value, that is important, that excites people, that galvanizes their imagination, then you will rise to the top. People will listen to you, and you'll do fine. And I think everybody has a chance to rise to the top simply by creating good stuff. We're developing this kind of internet nervous system like Twitter that signals to everybody what's good. So if something's really great, I can be sure that, you know, it will get out there and people will see it. It'll go viral. That's very powerful. I think this is very democratic. It's the way it should be. And in fact, it's the way it's going to be. This brief interregnum where mass media was brand new and very expensive is over. Everybody gets a chance to speak now.
I'd like to thank you very much for being on the show today. I know that you are broadcasting roughly how many hours a day is it that you broadcast now?
God, I don't even know. I think I do personally about 6 hours a day, 5 days a week. So that's about 30 hours. But then Tom Merritt comes in, does another couple, and we have other people, other hosts. I think we're doing about 40 hours a week of programming now.
And where can they find that programming at, sir?
Simple. Go to twit.tv or just Google the word TWIT.
Thanks very much for being on the show, Leo.
Thank you, Patrick. Good luck with your show.
Thank you.